But I don't know, something just grabbed me about Sugar Bowl. And I still to this day find it really hard to bottle what that is and explain it. But just this incredible heritage and style and vibe. It's like what skiing used to be, but in a really kind of beautiful way.
Welcome to the storm. I'm your host, Stuart Winchester. Tahoe, I just keep coming back to you. Why? Because it's some of the best damn skiing anywhere. Before I get to Sugar Bowl, a big, big thank you to all of my paid subscribers. This podcast is landing in your inbox 7 full days before it hits for everyone else. If you are still on the free tier, that benefit, among many others, is waiting for you when you upgrade to paid. The article previews that you're seeing right now are only about 20% of a typical Storm Skiing Journal article, so just a lot more ski content waiting for you, and it's a particular kind of ski content. Content that's not obsessed with stoke and bro culture, but is focused on the lift surf skiing universe that 99% of us actually inhabit and, you know, care about. So please head over to stormskiing.com. where you can upgrade to the paid tier, or if you're not signed up at all, at least get yourself in on the free version. You can also follow the Storm on the X platform or Instagram at Storm Ski Journal. All right, let's give a quick shout out to my amazing partner, Hotronics Ski Boot Foot Warmers and Heated Socks. This is a product I know really, really well, and honestly, that I value more than I could ever articulate in this short read. Because you know I love skiing more than just about anything, but what I hate more than just about anything is having cold feet. And my feet are always cold. Well, they used to be, but they're not anymore. You know why? Because I hooked myself up with Hotronic XLPC foot warmers in my ski boots. If you've had Hotronics before, you should know that the updated C series is the best on the market. With a new, larger anatomical shape, but with smaller, lighter batteries that perform in temperatures down to 22 degrees below zero. Or if you're looking for a less intrusive solution, consider Hotronic XLP heated socks. These socks offer the best size to capacity ratio and longevity on the market, with up to 18 hours of continuous heating power, and they will fit into your existing ski boots with no issue at all. And here is an awesome, awesome feature. The new generation of Hotronics products is Bluetooth enabled, meaning you can manage them from the Hotronic Heat app. It's time to ditch the tough guy mentality. Skiing should not be an exercise in endurance and managing discomfort. Hook yourself up with Hotronics boot warmers or heated socks this ski season. Click on the link in the banner on the podcast article to get started. Episode 165. Bridget Lagnavsky, president and CEO of Sugar Bowl, California. Sugar Bowl is one of those ski areas that, from its stat sheet, would seem to have everything going for it. A nice size skiable footprint, blanketed in 500 inches of average annual snowfall, some great steep terrain, a modern and reliable lift fleet, very little in the way of crowds, access right off a major interstate, and a quaint pedestrian village that tones down the franticness that can often define Tahoe skiing. But my guest today is fairly candid in acknowledging the struggles that even such an established and respected operation as Sugar Bowl has had in competing with the Epic and Icon passes, which have landed in Tahoe like an asteroid, redistributing skiers, it seems, in an uneven way that's been good crowd-wise for those who stuck with the independents, but more difficult for the folks charged with running these mountains as actual businesses. That's not to say that Sugar Bowl is struggling or fighting for its survival or endangered. But what it does mean is that the folks who run the place have to get creative as they adapt to this new, ever-changing, and stubborn reality. Fortunately, they've got lots of resources, lots of ideas, and lots of heart as they try to figure out what's next for this Lake Tahoe classic. Let's hear it. My guest today is in her second full season as president and CEO of Sugar Bowl, California. Sugar Bowl features 1,650 skiable acres spread across four mountains on a 1,500-foot vertical drop and is served by 12 lifts, including five high-speed quads. The ski area averages 500 inches of snow per winter, but racked up 809 inches during the 2022-23 winter and has already hit 404 inches for the current season as of March 13th. Prior to taking the top job at Sugar Bowl in 2022, she led Cardrona and Treble Cone ski areas in New Zealand. She has worked in the ski industry for more than 30 years. Bridget Legnavsky is my guest. Bridget, it looks like another incredible winter for Tahoe. I can't wait to dig into it with you. Welcome to the storm. How are you doing today, Bridget?
I'm great. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of snow around, that's for sure.
So we're recording this on March 13th, as I mentioned in the intro, but I want to start on that big storm that came through Tahoe at the beginning of March. 127 inches was the last snowfall total from that one storm, and it was a multi-day storm. Was that the final tally? What was that storm like?
Yeah, that's what the tally was in the end, 127. It was really hard to actually work out how much snow we'd had because there was a lot of wind with it as well, which is a little bit unusual for here, but it was great. And it came pretty intensely. We had a lot of snow last year as well, if anyone remembers March here last year. It was a little bit more, last year in March, it just snowed the whole time. It wasn't quite as intense. This came in 3 days, so it was kind of intense.
I mean, how do you even measure 127 inches of snow? Because we've all seen the social media posts with the snow stake, and that'll go up to 2-3 feet sometimes at some of these big Western mountains. But I'd imagine that it just, as you said, with all the wind and everything, it just gets lost. How do you measure that and get an accurate tally of what actually came through?
Yeah, well, I mean, we do have the snow stakes, but they do get very wind affected. So we actually utilize other data as well. So there's quite a lot of people measuring snow around the summit. So we take a look at plots all around the Donner Summit to really get an accurate estimate of what happens. And I think we just keep measuring. So it's a little bit like shoveling. You keep shoveling because if you stop, you drown. So you just have to kind of keep measuring and adding it together.
Your snow report on the Sugar Bowl website gives actually a range for season snowfall total. Is that reflective of how you measure snow? Do you do some at the bottom, some at the summit, some at mid-mountain? What's going on there?
Yeah, on our resort, we have plods at mid-mountain and the bottom, and they're quite different. So those are the two areas that we measure from.
Does mid-mountain tend to be the snowiest part given the exposed peaks you have?
Yeah. I think there's probably more snow at the top, but it's really hard to capture it because it's so exposed up there. So mid-mountain is the one that we usually look at.
So as you mentioned, last year was no slacker on snow. 809 inches, I believe, was your total. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. Did you have any single weather events, though, last season that compared to that 127 inches that you just saw?
Yep, 806, is that what you said? 806 inches is correct. I think about it in meters. It's a hell of a lot of meters of snow.
Right.
Never seen anything like over 20 meters of snow in a season. In New Zealand, our average is around about 3 meters.
Wow.
Yes, we did have weather events, but they were different. So the probably the most memorable weather event last year was over Christmas and New Year, and it was a rain event, and we had an enormous amount of rain and got flooded. All of our mid-mountain cafe got taken out. So nothing like that was worse, a lot mm-hmm. worse. We had, you know, staff accommodation flooding. We had restaurants flooding. And because of the weight of the snow too, obviously around the rain, we also had collapses of decks and things like that. So much more significant damage last year. This year, it was actually, we haven't had any damage yet. It's not till we take the blanket of snow down that we work out if we've lost anything.
Okay. So this latest event was pure snow, 127 inches. You had to actually shut the resort down for several days. I'm not sure if you had to shut down during the previous season at all, but take us through that decision-making process, because these big storms are just something that happens in Tahoe, but everyone hits different, as you said. One could hit as rain, one could hit as snow. And this time it necessitated a multi-day resort closure. So take us through the process of deciding to do that.
Yeah, so we did have a couple of days closed last season as well. And this season, we had 2 days closed during the storm, not several days. And the thing about Sugar Bowl that's unique is we actually have a community of people that live here. So we will always open until we can't. So on both of those days, we were out trying to open the whole day. And on the third day, we were doing the same thing and got open at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, because we do have what we would call sort of in resort people that still want to go skiing. And so there's always an encouragement. The thing about us is we lose I-80, the highways, and Old Forty. So people can't drive here, but the people that are here will climb through anything to get on a lift and go skiing, because, you know, they're great skiers and they love powder. So we will keep going. So those first few days we tried and tried and tried, but the wind is what caught us, and the wind will affect the lifts, obviously, but probably what affects us more is the continual reloading. So we can go up and shoot an area and make sure that it's had all of its avalanche clearance, but the next lap up it's all refilled, and that's actually what stops us from getting open.
Talk a little bit more about that community of folks that lives at Sugar Bowl. How many people actually live there on site in the village?
In the village itself at Sugar Bowl, there's 160 homes. So in a storm event like this, it's so funny, there's such stormtroopers. We'll see a flood of people come into those homes just before a storm. And wow. The reason they come in is because they're great skiers and they love powder. So when a storm is coming, this is the place to be, because storm riding here is incredible. So that's the village itself. So, you know, those houses are big, so there can be anything from a couple of people living in each of them to, you know, 10. So we could have 500 people, for example, on the resort during the storm. Then we have a slightly wider community or catch net of, you know, the Donna Summit, which includes the Donna Summit Road and also the homes and people in Serene Lakes. And on that third day that I talked about that we opened, I noticed a lot of people from Serene Lakes were here. So they'd somehow got out of their driveways, probably shoveled out and got themselves here. So they don't have to go onto an interstate or a main highway to get here. So we do have quite a captured audience right up here on the summit.
So how about you and the team? How many, I imagine you have to position some folks to stay on the mountain. I'm not sure if you have any actually living up there, if you actually live up there. What does that whole strategy look like when you know a big storm is coming up and you're going to have to get the place open? Do you have employees living up there? Do you house them temporarily? How does that all work?
Yes, that's it's a combination. I live on the resort. I live right next to the lodge, so I'm here the whole time. And then we've got several, I would say probably about 5 to 10 staff that live on the resort in staff accommodation that would work in a storm. And then there's probably another 20 that actually from food and beverage and departments like that that live on the resort in our dorms. The next closest staff accommodation for us is about 100, and that's on the Donna Summit Road. So up here on the summit, we house about 150 people. In a storm like this, because we need certain people here like patrol, like lift mechanics, groomer drivers, we will put them into accommodations. Some of them prefer to sleep in their offices, which is kind of a known thing up here. They'll just pull out their mattress and their sleeping bag. And it's like everyone has a little sleepover set, because you kind of have to. It's cute. Right. And people quite like that. And often we'll find that the hotel isn't full because people have either cancelled. Usually the hotel's full, but in a storm, some people leave early. So if we've got rooms in the hotel, we just put staff up there. And we had a bunch of people staying over the storm. There was probably about anything between 30 and 40 people living on the resort throughout that storm.
So it sounds like you plan ahead and have a lot of people on hand. And you mentioned the avalanche mitigation and the challenges there. Take us through what it takes to actually open a ski resort after 127 inches of snow, because we've all seen the Tahoe pictures. Sometimes whole lifts get buried. I can't even imagine the avalanche mitigation work with some of those open bowls and such you have to top a Sugar Bowl. Just talk about the effort of the team and what it takes to actually reopen for skiers within pretty short order after a big storm.
Probably a big shout out to our patrol. We've got an incredible, like unbelievable patrol team here that's sort of been here for decades, that know the mountain really well. That's probably the most important thing. And one of the things that you have to do in a situation like this is you have to keep controlling it. So you can't sit down and wait for 3 days and then try and go out and control it. So throughout the storm, the patrol team and the lift operators are constantly moving the lifts, keeping the lifts open and controlling the snow. So we have avalanche mitigation just going on all the time. And one of the reasons, you know, I said to you, we keep trying to open until we can't, is that's good for us to keep trying to open, because that actually keeps control of the snow, keeps the lifts moving. And there is a lot of pressure to get open because some of what you need is actually skier compaction. So you actually want skiers on it, because if we just sat back for 3 days and let that happen, it would be really hard to control and dangerous because you'd have big slides. Whereas we're having lots of little slides and little movements because it's, you know, it's just a constant. I describe it like shoveling. If you don't shovel your deck every hour, it turns into a big problem. But if you keep shoveling it every hour, you're fine.
That's interesting that you keep the lifts moving. You have quite a few chair lifts. You keep all of them moving during a big storm like that?
Not all of them at once, but definitely we try to open all the lifts every morning. So yes, we do get them moving, but we will stop them when we realise we can't get open. We keep haul ropes going on the gondola, just because we can take the cabins off the gondola and just keep the haul rope moving, because otherwise it freezes up and it's much better to keep it moving.
I was talking to the folks at Kirkwood last year and they were describing to me a little bit what it was like to dig out some of these lift terminals after a storm. And they were saying you have to be careful and it's hard to use the cats because you don't want to damage the lift. Just talk a little bit about that process and how the lift operations teams are able to re-expose those lifts when they've been buried under 10 feet of snow.
So one of the unique things here is we raise our lifts. So when we see the snow coming, we lift them, the bases. Cool. And otherwise, a lot of handwork until you're really comfortable that you can bring a groomer in. The groomer really just comes into the head trap and around it, but there's a lot of handwork that goes in. But we do raise our lifts significantly as the snow lifts, because you just simply couldn't have the same height lift in these snow conditions.
That's so interesting. I saw that over Japan in the summer. Obviously, I wasn't skiing, but went and rode a couple of lifts around. And they had the adjustables, which I'd not seen in the United States as much. So I think most folks have probably seen that famous Instagram image of Sugar Bowl that your marketing team put out last year and sort of reset that this year, that marketing door that's on the second floor. Tell us about this and how that represents the sort of winters you have at Sugar Bowl.
Yeah, I think with the marketing team, they're desperately trying to show how much snow we've got. And that was a great image to show how much snow. There was other routes into the building, so it wasn't as dramatic as kind of what's come out. I mean, I think the message for us from a team perspective is that there's a lot of snow here, and what we really want people to know is the conditions are going to be incredible for the next 2 months. So we extended our opening right out to the end of April. So really it's about giving a message that there's a lot of snow, but there are other ways into the marketing building. You know, most of the buildings here at Sugar Bowl are built really high. So you'll see the bottom layer, we expect to go under snow for the season. So they're designed for that. So if you look around at all the houses, we expect the bottom layer to be under snow. So that's a little bit like what the marketing building is. And so there's other routes in, which is upstairs and to higher entries and exits. It's not dramatic for us. It's kind of just how it's designed.
So tons of snow came in and that gave you the confidence to extend the season, which you did last year as well. What's your anticipated closing date at the moment, Bridget?
We've extended through to the 28th of April. So that's our closing date now. We were the 7th of April. So we kind of Amazing. Operationally expect that anyway, but we try to make sure that we've got the snow before we make that call. And then we're running multiple training events post that in May. We're running an athlete conference, which we're pretty excited about, and also some alpine race training.
Any chance you make it into May?
Yeah, I mean, we could. We absolutely could. I think, you know, what will happen is people will start doing summer sports. It's kind of something that the ski industry deals with, is that people stop skiing before the snow finishes. It's really difficult, especially with the way the seasons are changing. People want to ski when it's cold. So, like, they want to ski in fall. And they push and push and push for those early season conditions, which are usually really horrible. And when the snow builds up during the season and it's getting later and later, and it gets really, really good in the spring, people actually start getting their jet boats out and their mountain bikes out, and they want to do different things. So it's actually more of a challenge keeping visitation up than actually holding on to the snow.
So Palisades Tahoe made it to 4th of July last year. I realized Sugar Bowl shut down before that because of the volume issues you're talking about. But just being on the mountain, living there, how late could you have stayed open, do you think, if the demand would have been there?
Probably the same sort of time, or absolutely the same sort of time that Palisades stayed open for. It got very wet and, your feet would kind of go through the snow, but there was still a lot of snow around, even, you know, for a few good hours of skiing a day. There was a lot of people up here just enjoying the mountain. We really love uphill and touring, so we really allow that to happen. So it was great to see so many of the village community up here still skiing right through to July. In fact, on July the 4th, we had an uphill event with the villagers, and we all skinned the top of Lincoln. So that's how much snow there still was, right from the bottom to the top of Lincoln on snow.
Oh my gosh, that's incredible.
Yeah.
So when did it actually all melt away? August?
Yeah, about August, September. It was really late. There was a slither through the Silver Belt, which was just awesome all summer. Mm-hmm. So there was just an enormous amount of snow to melt away. I think once we hit September, it had gone, all gone.
Were people still sneaking up to ski that little sliver?
Oh yeah. People are really keen on skiing here. It's amazing.
Unbelievable. All right. Well, you're relatively new to the Tahoe ski scene. As I mentioned in the intro, your second full season, but you've been in skiing for a long time. As folks can probably guess from your accent, you grew up in New Zealand. Tell us about that. Did you grow up skiing there?
Yeah, I grew up in New Zealand. I grew up in a little ski town. And, you know, it was kind of the way it is for a lot of people that get into the industry. They've grown up or been in it since a child. A little place called Tekapo. Skied my whole life. You know, did some ski racing through school. I was an extreme skier for a little bit back in the day, you know, when we tried to do it on long, skinny skis. And then most of my career was as a ski instructor. So I moved and did a phys ed degree, which was my first degree, and then became a ski instructor. Well, throughout that time, I was becoming a ski instructor. So that was kind of my career pathway, and ran events department, did a lot of training and work for the New Zealand Ski Instructors Alliance, was on the demo team for about 12 years, and then gradually kind of moved into management from there. First ski school management, guest services, and then general management. And that's kind of my journey. In that time, I was a ski instructor. I think there was about 15 years there that went back-to-back seasons. So I worked in Colorado and Europe. Mm.
So you've worked at all different levels, and you've also been a consumer of it. And it sounds like you've been around skiing your entire life, and that a lot of that was in New Zealand. I'm really curious about New Zealand skiing and New Zealand ski culture. What can you tell us about it? And most of my audience is US and Canada. What can you tell us about it in the context of how it's distinct from US ski culture, and what makes New Zealand ski culture special?
Well, New Zealand, it's kind of changing, and you can imagine growing like a little mushroom. But it's a lot. I mean, the resorts are smaller. They're all above alpine. You know, the towns are down low. There's big, scary gravel roads to get up to the top, mud chains, all that stuff. So it's a bit harder core. But I think what's really unique about it is it's and probably the piece that I miss the most, it's like a little melting pot of ski and snowboard. So you get all sorts of people down there every year. And I mean, I love the community that we had, especially of high performance and, you know, world-class athletes that would come down and train there for the season from all parts of the world. And it also meant that your workforce was really diverse. So the workforce was kind of a world-class workforce. So you'd have this kind of melting pot of everyone that wanted to do a double season would come down to New Zealand and work there. So enormous amount of capability and strength in the workforce, but also in the customers, in the visitors.
Did meeting those folks, is that what inspired you to do the double winter in Colorado and in Europe? And where did you work and how did you like that?
I think for Kiwi ski instructors, it's just a way of life. Like I was ski instructor since I was 18. My first season was Japan. It was just what you did. You know, you've got your job and then you've got to work out what am I going to do for the rest of the year. So you go ski instructing. And back in the day, it was really easy to get visas up to the US. And it was a really good way to make a living because the US dollar is so strong when you go back down to New Zealand. So that was kind of just the way of life. And it was more New Zealanders or the Southern Hemisphere people doing that than the opposite. Like we all went overseas, but you only get a little sprinkle of people that choose to come down to New Zealand. Because when you go up to the Northern Hemisphere, there's just the whole world is open. Whereas New Zealand only had kind of one or two resorts.
So where did you work in Colorado in Europe?
I was 6 years in Breckenridge, which I loved, nice. And then 4 years in Aspen.
So you're doing these double winters, and that's kind of a way of life. Do you miss that? Do you miss, or do you like having summers?
Oh, no, I love summers. But I still kind of do travel a lot. My son skis competitively, and my husband coaches him. So they're constantly following the best snow conditions. And because of that, I'm just jumping in all the time to go and join them. So I will go down to New Zealand for a bit of time this year, and I probably will go to Europe at some point. So I still try my hardest to get around because I love that. I love traveling. I love seeing what other people are doing. It's kind of been a way of life for me. And if I didn't do that, I'd really miss it. But I have to say, One of my favorite things about living in California is the weather. And oh my goodness, summers are incredible.
Yeah, California has everything. It's ocean, mountains, deserts, cities. So, you know, New Zealand skiing, I think for a lot of my listeners, is this exotic sounding thing. And we hear a lot about the ski fields and the nutcracker lifts and the nasty roads and everything you were talking about to get up there. The two ski areas that you most recently managed, Cardrona and Treble Cone, they look more like North American ski areas insofar as they have big trail networks and chairlifts. I realize they're above treeline, but tell us about these two ski areas specifically, what it was like to run them and how they're different from maybe your typical New Zealand ski area.
Well, there's only really four big ski resorts in the South Island, which is, you know, Coronet Peak, Remarkables, Cadrona and Treble Cone. And then, of course, Whakapapa and Turoa up in the North Island. And then other than that, it's made up of a whole bunch of smaller resorts, which I think kind of is what people think of when they think of things like nutcrackers and walking to ski resorts and things like that. And I grew up on a small resort. My home resort as I grew up was Mount Dobson. And when I was a child, it was a nutcracker. And that was just the way it was. As people travel and access is so good, it becomes very similar. We learn from each other. Cadrona and Treble Cone was an interesting combination. Cadrona is very big, very flat, very high, very commercial, very busy. Treble Cone is in Wanaka too, and it's a little bit more like Sugar Bowl. It's steep, it's for skiers, it's for season pass holders, and it has a lot of vertical, and it was a lot quieter. And I ran Cadrona for a lot longer. I was at Cadrona for 30 years, and we went through the acquisition of Treble Cone just before COVID, actually, thank goodness. Running Cadrona, the things that are hard is the road. Like, the road is, you know, a monster to manage, whereas here, you know, it's a lot easier, even though Sugar Bowl is quite unique because we manage Old 40, which is the highway up from Donna Lake up to Sugar Bowl. So we still do manage the road, but it was a lot more tricky than New Zealand one because of just weather and conditions and how long it was and how remote it was. And then the other thing with running resorts in New Zealand, there's way more wind than I've experienced here in California, at least. So every day you're battling the wind. It's constantly monitoring lifts and working out how we can build lifts that are going to be more resistant to the wind. And as climate change is hitting and that we're getting these extreme weather events, it was even getting more intense because they would come in so much quicker. So your thresholds had to come down because you didn't know what you were going to get. So I would say the wind and the weather and the exposure made managing in New Zealand much harder.
So a challenging set of circumstances, but one that you had gotten used to over three decades of working there. Then the opportunity comes up to lead Sugar Bowl, move you and your family across the ocean. How did that opportunity come up, Bridget, and why did it appeal to you?
I've had a change in New Zealand in my last year, and a lot of it was post-COVID. I had moved into a role called Chief Experience Officer for the tourism company that had purchased the ski resorts. So I was very much in the office on an aeroplane driving because we had businesses all across the South Island, Real NZ, so boats, farms, attractions, plus the ski resorts. And as a result, I wasn't skiing very much and I was spending less and less time at the ski resorts, which it was great. It was a great adventure and I was really enjoying it. And then I actually just got a phone call out of the blue. I had no idea, from the recruiter, and went, oh yeah. So I'm always sort of one of these people that goes yes, yes, yes until I say no, just because I love looking at opportunities. So oh yeah, okay. I don't know what that's all about. Let's have a look. Then we had a chat and we talked and talked, and then they said, do you want to come over and have a look? And probably the key to it was I hadn't traveled for 3 years because we'd been stuck in New Zealand and it was really, really unusual.
Right.
For me not to travel, and the opportunity to get back out into the world was just like, oh yeah, definitely I'm coming up to have a look. And I didn't really think that much of it. And then when I came up to Tahoe to have a look, I came up to the resort. It was summertime, so I didn't really get to fully appreciate how good the skiing was. But I don't know, something just grabbed me about Sugar Bowl, and I still to this day find it really hard to bottle what that is and explain it. But just this incredible heritage and style and vibe. It's like what skiing used to be, but in a really kind of beautiful way. And then I met the board. And once I met the board here, which is essentially a group of the homeowners, I was just like, now I can really learn something from these people. They're incredible. They're so kind. Like, I'd never really felt a genuine respect and love for the sport and the resort like the homeowners do here. And then, you know, there was other things that came, and I kind of came home and talked to my family, and my whole family were like, oh yeah, let's do it. They were into it and into the adventure. And I was like, oh yeah, you know, you've turned 50, you've been doing the same thing your whole life, why don't you just go on an adventure? And that's kind of how it happened.
So it started as an adventure, and we all love an adventure, but it's a whole other thing to move somewhere else. How has the adjustment been to life in the United States for you and your family?
You know, it's been easy and great. We're pretty worldly. We've traveled a lot. My son and husband were in the Northern Hemisphere for about 9 out of 12 months a year anyway, somewhere.
Oh, wow.
So they were really comfortable. They'd been stationed in Breckenridge when my son was younger, and then more recently in Laax in Switzerland. And then just traveling. And my daughter's just like totally into adventure, and she skis too, but not as competitively. And she loves drama and musical theater. And she was just like, America, here we come. I think she thought she was heading to Hollywood. So they loved it. And you know, it was pretty easy because I am living in the manager's house here. So I didn't have to deal with kind of selling houses and buying houses and stuff immediately. And we're loving living on the resort. So at the moment, we're really happy with that. But pretty comfortable with traveling and moving anyway, so it wasn't too big a deal, and the family's loving it.
The On Mountain manager's house, is that a requirement that you live there just given the crazy weather that you get in Tahoe, or is that a perk that you can take advantage of if you want to?
I think it's a combination. You have to have someone on the resort all the time, and you know, I could probably ask one of the other managers to live there if they wanted to, but I'm really happy doing it. I mean, people think that I'm mad, but I think that when you've spent your whole life in the ski industry like I have, it's just how it is. You know, your job and your lifestyle have to be the same. You can't separate it because it kind of is all one thing. So if you don't really love skiing and love snow, it would be really hard. But, you know, this is my life. If I had a day off, I'd be here skiing. So that's what I love about it.
Well, it sounds like you have the love, and you were already familiar with U.S. skiing, and you'd spent several winters here. However, it's a different thing to run a resort than to be an instructor at one. Now that you've had a couple seasons at Sugar Bowl to compare to your experience in New Zealand, what's the biggest adaptation you've had to make as an operator? And I guess there's kind of two ways to answer this. One is just as far as the mechanics of it and all the snow you get in Tahoe. And the other part is cultural. And I'm just curious about the cultural differences between the two countries and how you have to balance that as a resort operator.
This is kind of a big question, because running the resort, to me, the challenge is just the same as what it always is. Like, it's very familiar to me. There's all sorts of things that go on. It's incredibly complex. Running the village is new for me. So Sugar Bowl is like you run a resort and you run a village. It's two things. The biggest challenge for me is in New Zealand, over the years that I'd spent in Wanaka and in the tourism industry, I was really well networked. So if I wanted to call the council, I knew exactly who to call and who to talk to. If I wanted to, you know, do anything with consenting or entitlements, or I wanted to talk to the Environmental Society, or, you know, wanted to talk to the Prime Minister, for goodness sake, you know, it was easy. The network was so good. And I was very involved in a lot of, in fact, probably too involved, but I was kind of in a lot of boards and committees and task force and things. So I was very involved in that. And I think the hardest thing for me here is that just disappeared overnight. I don't know who to call or what to call or who to get. And just luckily, I've got some amazing staff here that have that, and I'm having to lean on them. But that's probably the biggest challenge, is coming into a new culture where you don't know anybody and nobody knows you. So nobody knows my background or my capability or what I've done. And I don't know the process for going through, you know, entitlements for new lifts or that kind of stuff. So that's been the biggest challenge, is kind of almost cutting every tie you had in terms of your own personal network for your job and having to start again.
So have you addressed that? Have you started to slowly join some of these boards and community network? Are you leaning more on your team as you get to know the resort? How have you handled that mentally?
I haven't joined any boards or anything yet. In New Zealand, I was on literally everything and it was quite overwhelming. And so I'm kind of happy. It actually means that I can have a lot more personal time and do things with my family, which I really enjoy. And when it comes to networks into all the tricky technical stuff of, you know, running a resort and developing a resort, I lean quite heavily on the team that's been here a long time. You know, our VP of Operations, Jenna Prescott, has got a huge wealth of knowledge in that space. And Chris Parker, who has been here as long as I'd been at Cadrona, who does all of our development, has all of those networks and ties. And so, you know, it's about utilizing your team a lot more. And I'm really lucky to have a great team around me.
So culturally, what has been the biggest difference in running a ski resort in America and in Northern California specifically, as compared to running one in New Zealand?
I mean, in New Zealand, it was pretty multicultural. So you had a little bit of everything. I think probably the biggest thing about America is around legislation, as you probably, everyone's really aware of. I'm really trying to anchor myself when it comes to things like risk. So risk, my whole life has been about human risk. And it's a big focus for me, sustainability and risk. Whereas here, risk is more about legislative risk and making sure you've got yourself covered. And I find that a real challenge when actually what I want to do is make sure everyone's safe. You know, there is an element here where you have to make sure the company's safe. And I think that if I can blend my background into that, we'll get the best result.
All right, let's talk about that company a little bit. You know, Sugar Bowl, pretty much everyone knows, is an independent ski area, and large independent ski areas are becoming a little bit of an endangered species out west. So tell us about the folks that you work for, Bridget, and who owns Sugar Bowl today.
So Sugar Bowl is owned by a bunch of shareholders, and all of those shareholders are, at the moment, homeowners too. And not all homeowners are shareholders. And there is a possibility that you could be a shareholder and not a homeowner. It's not necessarily connected. But generally, most homeowners are a shareholder of the resort. And like I said, there's about 150, 160 homes. The board is incredible, made up of just a beautiful bunch of very, very clever people that have done very well in their own work life. I'm learning a heap from them and they're incredibly supportive. The thing that blew me away right at the start with Sugar Bowl that I still really, really love is that the shareholders love to ski. Like, above all, they love to ski and they care most about the experience that they're having. And there's an enormous respect for the sport. Like, they're all adventurers. You know, they love living in a snowbound village and they love that there's a bit of hardship with getting here. And, you know, we've dedicated a whole area to racing. Like, nobody can go into that area. It's just for racing. I've never seen that done at a ski resort before. That blew my mind. But you know, I thought, well, how do people cope with this? But it's like the ski community here look at the kids ski racing and are really proud of them. And they look at them as the future Olympians. Where in New Zealand, to close a slope for something, we would get so many complaints. Whereas here, it's like they don't complain because they respect what we're doing and what the kids are doing, which that just blows me away. So we're in a really unique, and this is kind of part of the reason I'm here, obviously, really unique situation where you've got a bunch of people that truly love and respect the sport and care most about the experience. I think part of your question is, like, we're an independent resort surrounded by Icon and Epic. And that's making it really hard for Sugar Bowl to survive because there's two ways for a resort to run, and it has to run off revenue, right? And there's two ways to get that. One is to increase visitation or to increase price. And so, you know, we have to have a really, really unique strategy that kind of handles both, if that makes sense. Like, how do you create a premium product and how do you get more people here? That's a piece that I find really interesting because that has to be our strategy. We have to almost live like a hybrid. And I think what's adding complexity to that is the costs of running ski resorts are just escalating. So margins are becoming really tough. So, you know, things like the power bills have gone up 40% this year. It's just huge, and labor costs are getting higher and higher. And yet you're under pressure to keep your season pass low because of the Epic and Icon model. So I think for Sugar Bowl to be successful, we have to work out how to deliver on a hybrid model that gets us enough revenue to cover our costs. That's basically what it is. And it's not easy.
So as you look around and you have North Star to your east, you have Palisades Tahoe right to your south, has the board considered selling Sugar Bowl or joining one of these larger coalitions?
Look, I think over the years, yes, they have. And I think we would be completely mindless to not consider it. You know, everything should be considered because, like I said, there's kind of two parts to our strategy. One is increasing visitation and one is improving the premium area. And if we want to increase visitation, we can spend a whole lot of money on marketing and fight, or we could join something like that. You know, we've got to make those choices. And at the moment, you know, we are trying to do it ourselves. But definitely, I mean, we shouldn't be not considering that as an option.
You did join Mountain Collective last year. Did that have the impact that you hope it would?
Well, I think Mountain Collective is just such a wonderful bunch of resorts that have come together. And I think for us, it's about being in a wider network and having other people to bounce ideas and off. And, you know, having a joint marketing program, of course, it's good. We don't see a massive amount in California, but we see some. But I think it's hard to measure what the marketing power is. But I would say we're stoked with being part of Mountain Collective, being part of that community, learning and bouncing around, you know, ideas with that community has been great. And I'm sure any of the joint marketing is helpful. And we are seeing some numbers out of it.
So we see a lot of overlap between the Mountain Collective Pass and the Icon Pass. And often we've seen mountains join the Mountain Collective as sort of a warm-up to Icon. Have you considered joining the Icon Pass because there is such a large number of Icon Pass holders already in California, and Palisades Tahoe certainly is at capacity a lot of the time?
I mean, I think this is kind of the same answer to the question before. Yeah, of course, we should consider it. It could be one way to get our visitation up. It's not an easy answer because part of the beauty of Sugar Bowl is the fact that it's uncrowded and the villagers and the community here really, really value that. So it wouldn't be the easiest answer in the world. We've got to work out how do we get the visitation up to what we need, but not to the point that we start to change the experience.
Yeah, as you talk to the homeowners and the local pass holders, do you get a sense of the sentiment from them overall? Is there a kind of consensus that Sugar Bowl should remain independent?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think people would like us not to tell anyone else about it. Someone came up with a marketing idea, which is quite good, and it should be Sugar Bowl. and I thought that was actually quite good, but at the same time, we need more people here. So it's a balance about how do we get enough people to sustain the resort, but not too many people that we change the experience.
I mean, it is so tricky because you have such a dense concentration of ski resorts that are around Lake Tahoe. Three of them are on the Epic Pass, North Star, Heavenly, and Kirkwood. And then you have the one Palisades Tahoe on the Icon Pass. And you have a lot of big independents that you're also competing against, like Homewood, Mount Rose, Diamond Peak, Sierra at Tahoe. What do you see as the distinguishing factor for Sugar Bowl, Bridget? Why should folks come to Sugar Bowl when they have all these other options around Tahoe?
Yeah, I mean, that's a question that we have to constantly ask ourselves and keep focused on. But, you know, Sugar Bowl clearly is the closest to the Bay Area, the first large resort that you come across. So that's a really big strength. I mean, I can get down to the Bay in 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Oh, wow.
So it's really, without traffic, by the way.
Yeah.
Right. It's really close and really convenient to get to. I think Sugar Bowl is made up of three things that make it really special. And it's a combination and almost the sort of vastly contrasting things that make it so unique. Number one is its heritage. You walk in here and it's like walking into something from a museum. It's incredible. Like it was 1939, first up, the way you come in, the buildings, the vibe, the style is just, you can almost see the ghosts of the movers and shakers of the Californian coast coming inland on a train and deciding to build a ski resort. It's just beautiful. Then you've got this really tight-knit community where everyone knows each other. So you hop into the lift line and you're talking to people. And this is just not me. Everyone's talking to each other. So you feel like you're part of a larger family. And people love that you kind of know each other. And then, you know, you can jump to under the bar at the end of the day, or actually only after a few hours because you get tired because the skiing's so full on. You all know each other. And then the kind of contrast to all of that is how outrageous the skiing is. It's not huge, but what we've got is incredible skiing, and you can lap around and get the most amazing runs, enormous amounts of untrapped powder because we just don't have the volume of people here, to really steep faces. I mean, this week we opened the Palisades and I, you know, finally got enough courage to go and ski them because they bottom out. And I mean, it just blows me away that, you know, we can get this, and I'm so proud of our team that we can get that kind of terrain open on a ski resort. And that's because of the level of skiers and almost the courtesy of the skiers, and people are really nice and kind. And so you've got this kind of amazing skiing, amazing community, and then this kind of styly heritage that is kind of hard to put your finger on. That's what I think makes Sugar Bowl really unique.
What does a busy day look like at Sugar Bowl from a lift line point of view? If you know, after you get those big powder storms, and I'm talking about a day when all the roads are open and people can actually get there.
Yeah, so the biggest day we have, the comfortable carrying capacity at Sugar Bowl is 5,400 people. The biggest day we've had has been 5,000 people here this year. Okay. Wow. So we're below our comfortable carrying capacity. And with that, the lift lines are never longer than 7 minutes. The only time I've ever seen a decent lift line is when we've had lifts down. So if a lift goes down for maintenance reasons or something, that will put a bit of pressure on some of the lower lifts. But I haven't seen a lift line in my whole time here longer than about 7 minutes.
So one of the more unique lifts in California is your Village gondola. And I believe that's what you're referring to when you say it's a little bit hard to get there because it requires a little bit of effort. And I don't know if there's any way to drive up to the Village. But talk about that Village gondola and this very unique piece of Sugar Bowl and how that fits into your heritage and the character of the resort.
Yeah, when I said that about being hard to get into, and that is because the Village's highest value is that the resort remains snowbound. So to remain snowbound, it means we can't have cars in here or vehicles. And I tell you what, living without cars around is a game changer. Like my whole life, my outlook on life, my thinking about things has changed so much by just simply not having the rat race of cars and mud and slush and noise around you. It is white, it is quiet, it's like walking into Narnia. So the Village gondola is basically the way to make sure that we keep the Village snowbound. The Village gondola is 80 years old, so it's pretty old. It's like an attraction in itself. you rattle across and you come into the Village. And once you get into the Village, it's by foot to get to your home. And so people will grab a sled and put their groceries or whatever they've got on a sled and drag it through the woods to their home. And it's so cool.
So it's a really cool aesthetic element that you have these old school four passenger gondola cars. We've seen, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Mad River Glen in Vermont, but they have a single chair. And when they rebuilt the lift, it dates to the 1940s. And when they rebuilt the lift in 2007, they rebuilt it as a single chair because they liked that personality piece of it. Is there the same thinking around the gondola where even if you do modernize it, upgrade it, you would still keep it with that retro look just as part of the atmospheric piece of the resort?
Yeah, it's a really good question and one that we're sort of heavily, heavily focused on right now. What do we do with the gondola? Mm-hmm. Because we've got to do something with it. And gondola companies like Doppelmayr would much prefer to put a brand new gondola in. In fact, they probably wouldn't touch it. We'd have to find someone with a skill set that could basically restore it and keep it alive. But that would be a case of building and making specific parts because no one else is making parts for us anymore, building and making specific cabins. So it is a possibility. It's not the easiest, and it's probably going to be not the cheapest. Not that anything to do with gondolas is cheap. So it is a very large focus of us right now is what we can do with the gondola moving forward. And of course, it's even more complex than that. It goes under power lines and over a railway. So it's possibly untouchable.
How urgent is some action on the gondola? Is it mechanically sound? Is it just a matter of it's getting hard to find parts? What's behind the push to really start thinking seriously about the gondola?
Look, we've tested everything. We get it certified constantly. So it is mechanically absolutely sound. I think the hard thing is parts in finding parts. You know, things will break down or things will happen, and how do we fix it when it does? Because it's not like we can ring the company and get a new one. And, you know, it is old. So there'll be things that will come up that we'll find, and we'll have to go, well, okay, how are we going to fix this? And at some point we might not be able to. That's the risk with the gondola.
So you have that cool classic lift. The rest of the lift fleet is pretty modern. As I mentioned in the intro, you have 5 high-speed quads. All of those were replaced between 1994 and 2005. Curious, as you survey the mountain, are you still pretty happy with these high-speed quads? Is it time to think about replacing some of them? Jerome Hill is 30 years old this year. Is there any that maybe you would like to upgrade to a six-pack? Just what's your thought on that fleet of high-speed quads that you have?
The uphill capacity is fine. That's kind of the main thing. And the lifts are all in really good order. We have a great lift maintenance team, and we keep them in good order. Lifts do last, obviously, with an 80-year-old one for a really long time. So we will have to start thinking, and we do have a kind of what we call an asset management plan, where we have a rollout of the lifts and replacement, but nothing immediate is required in terms of, you know, getting more capacity or gaining more space, because the resort's plenty big enough with what we've got.
So I think folks who have been watching Sugar Bowl for a long time may have been surprised with your most recent lift installation, which was the Crow's Peak Triple back in 2013. I realize this happened long before you arrived and those decisions have been made, but do you think that a triple chair is appropriate for that terrain, given the challenging nature of it, or do you wish they would have put a quad over there?
It's not a particularly busy lift. So triple, I mean, when you're looking at, you know, the size of the seats, it's really about how much capacity you can get. There's plenty of capacity over there. It doesn't need more capacity. It would almost be an overcapitalization to put something high speed and six pack over there, because you just wouldn't fill it. I mean, the triple's not even getting filled. So I think it's a fine lift for there. The Crow's terrain is phenomenal, and I think probably a little bit confusing because of that. When things are really phenomenal and unique, it's not obvious. When it was put in, we didn't cut any trails. So it's been put in except for, you know, what was sort of adjacent to the Disney area. So it's almost like going for a backcountry ski inbounds. So you go up Crows and you take off, and honestly, it's all trees, it's all glades, nothing's developed. It feels like you're in the backcountry, and it's amazing. And so because of that, it's not really the most popular, because only really good skiers go there. Yeah, it's not particularly steep either. It doesn't have groomers. So, you know, certain people go there. And I know for a lot of people here, Crows is their favorite place to go, especially on a powder day.
Prior to that chair being installed, there was another Crow's Peak lift that ran parallel to Disney Express. That was an old double chair. They took that out shortly after installing the Crow's Peak Triple. Just curious, from your point of view, surveying the mountain, do you have a wish list for lift upgrades? Do you want to add maybe anything else in the beginner area, any more carpets or anything? Are you pretty happy with the lift fleet, other than maybe that gondola upgrade that we talked about?
Like I said, the lift fleet, I think, is absolutely perfect for the amount of people we have here, aspiration to the amount of people we want here. We don't just want to keep growing the resort. We want to build to our capacity, and that's it. The area that I think we could really improve, and it will take a bit of work, is our first time in beginner terrain. There's a whole bunch of terrain over at the top of White Pine that is incredibly beautiful. It's flat, it's in the trees. And when I look at it, I believe it could be the best first time teaching terrain I've ever seen. And we're not using it. It's kind of at the top of the lift rather than at the bottom. So, and at the bottom of White Pine, it's quite steep, and it's kind of a little bit congested. So I think that I would love to see us develop our first time terrain, because I do believe we could have the best first timers or beginners offering in the US. Because of the fact that you can sort of get to it so easily from a city or from my old 80, and then it's all this kind of flat terrain amongst the trees and the shade, because a lot of the time learning to ski is quite exhausting. And so I think we could really develop our first time beginner terrain a lot.
And what would that look like? Would it be putting more carpets up toward the top portion of that lift and maybe offering folks a download like we've seen with some of these mid-mountain gondolas at Jackson Hole and other places? Have you thought through logistically what that area could look like?
I think we could move the magic carpets and have a series of magic carpets that sort of takes you up to the top. And then as you develop and, you know, do your first time lesson, you get better and you learn to turn, you could ski down to the bottom. And there's like a progressive way that we could get people up and out of the base, and it would be beautiful. And then Jerome and Judah has got some of the most epic groomed blue terrain as well. So just connecting that progression from first time onto those lifts and really improving that blue offering as well would be, or green, sort of green blue offering as well would be, it, I mean, means that it could, all that segment of skier could stay connected. And that's what I think would be great to develop.
Yeah, that's a perfect little beginner area. And given where it is with its own parking lot, you could almost, maybe you already do have this, a separate ticket just for beginners for that area.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's something we do. So we have a cheaper ticket for just using White Pine area.
Nice. So when you were hired, longtime president and general manager Greg Dallas transitioned into a vice chairman role with the focus on executing the resort's master plan. What can you tell us about the master plan? I know we've been talking a lot about lifts and terrain and such, but I think that this master plan is a little more base area focused. But what's Greg's big focus? What's the master plan and how's it coming along?
Greg did an incredible job pulling together a lot of data, a lot of facts around, you know, what's the best way to develop Sugar Bowl? Because it really is two portals and we don't really have enough numbers to warrant two portals. So a lot of this was about connecting the portals and making sure that Judah becomes kind of the base of Sugar Bowl and ensuring that we can have all of our ticketing, rental, retail, all the stuff that connects to a skier day all in one spot. Because the way it was being run is like it had to be duplicated and it doesn't work. There's just not enough people to make it work. So finding a way to bring people into the village, and once you arrive in the village, it's just the village experience rather than trying to set the village up like a ski resort was a big piece of this. And then really developing the Judah base to become the main base. Because right now when people come to Sugar Bowl, it's like, oh, how do I get there? Oh, come to Judah. When you're really trying to say come to Sugar Bowl. Right. And just really simplifying the message to guests so that they knew where to come to. So I thought that work that he has done on that has been fantastic.
Is there an opportunity for another gondola link between Judah and the village that would maybe help move folks around a little bit more? Or is that not something you've considered?
Yeah, that definitely is one of the key options. And that was part of the master plan, is looking at connecting. You come into the main base of Sugar Bowl. And when you get into the main base of Sugar Bowl, you can still transport across to the village via gondola and arrive in the snowbound village. It's a very short gondola. The first question is, do you really need it? But the reality is, if the highest value of keeping the village snowbound and quiet is there, it is the best way to bring people in. Because otherwise we'd end up with a whole lot of, you know, rangers and skidoos and groomers moving people around, which isn't necessarily ideal either. So yes, that's definitely on the cards.
What's the opportunity? Because you mentioned there's a bunch of folks who live in the village, they love the village, and then there's a hotel. And when you're there during a storm, it's a really special experience. What's the opportunity to create more of that sort of slopeside housing? Is there a strong desire to maybe keep it limited so you don't lose that atmosphere? Or are you looking around at opportunities to say, okay, this is really cool, we can make this maybe even bigger?
Yeah, so we're doing some work right now. We've got two sort of plans going on. The plan you talked about that Greg had started and led, and also the village core plan. And part of that village core plan is, what does the village core look like? Because we don't want it to feel like another ski area base, which is kind of how it had evolved. And so that's going on right now, that master planning. And part of that will be defining what size we want, A, the village to be, and B, whether we want to increase our hotbeds inside the village. So that work is going on right now. But I can tell you that nobody wants it to be too busy and too crowded. So getting to the point that it's sustainable is probably the focus rather than busy or bigger. Growth is not the plan. It's more about getting it sustainable.
So lots of work to do around the base area. And we talked about the lifts. Curious, Sugar Bowl, as many of your peer resorts are, operates on Forest Service land, which we alluded to earlier. Are you maxed out terrain-wise? Is the resort as big as it can get? Are there any opportunity expansions in any direction?
So only part of the resort's on Forest Service land. Some of it's private. And I think in terms of the volume that we want here, the size of the skiable terrain is as big as it needs to be. If anything, we develop the beginner area a little bit more and probably develop better lift access inside the village so people don't have to walk so far to get to a lift. But nothing huge in terms of wanting to get more terrain.
You know, it gets crowded in certain directions. When you look on Google Maps, you realize just how close some of these neighboring ski areas are to you. And one interesting thing about Tahoe is that there's a lot of big ski areas, but there's also still a lot of small ski areas, family-oriented ski areas. Soda Springs, Boreal, Donner Ski Ranch, Tahoe Donner are all right around you. Does Sugar Bowl have any kind of relationship with these smaller resorts, which probably aren't your competitors directly, but there may be a good opportunity to have a pipeline from them and folks learning up to the bigger mountain experience at Sugar Bowl? But what is that relationship like on the ground?
I mean, we're more friendly neighbors than anything else. We don't have a connected pass or anything like that. Definitely different segments will choose different areas because mainly around pricing, and that's probably how people segment themselves coming onto the summit. And Soda Springs is obviously owned by Boreal, so those two are connected quite tightly. And I think with Donner Ski Ranch, who's kind of at our gateway, we just have a great friendly relationship, partnership relationship with them. We make sure our staff can both ski at each resort. We love going to their bar and restaurant. You know, it's fun, nice. But we don't have a joint pass with them, no. It's quite a different segment of people that choose to go to each place.
Yeah, the pricing element that you just mentioned is interesting. I was speaking with your peer, Greg Gavrilets, who runs Mount Rose, and they have a pricing structure pretty similar to yours as far as lift tickets go. And I was just looking at your website, and for the most of the rest of March, even in spite of all the snow you just got, you could go right now and buy a Sugar Bowl midweek lift ticket for $99. Palisades Tahoe, on the other hand, is over $200. North Star is over $200 most days. So what kind of a competitive advantage does that give you? Because everyone has these high weekend tickets now, right? But the big players have really applied that to weekday too, because they really want to sell that mega pass. But Sugar Bowl has settled on that $99 starting point, at least for weekdays. How much does that help when you are looking to compete against Epic and Icon?
The reason our pass is so cheap during the week is we have so much capacity. We have no chance of selling out. All of our business comes on the weekends, which is, it's a California thing, I have to say. But I mean, Icon, both Palisades and North Star particularly, at least have hotels and hotbeds up their streets, you know. We have 27 rooms in our hotel and that's it. So if you don't have hotbeds, it's really, really hard to demand a high price for midweek. One of the things that's astonished me coming into California, and I actually think back now and go, I never thought of coming skiing to Tahoe. Because it's not like an international or a global destination. And I don't know why. It's the best skiing I've ever had in my life here.
Right.
So I'm kind of shocked by it. I don't quite get it. But yeah, it doesn't have the kudos that, you know, people go to Colorado, they go to New Zealand, they go to Europe, and they come in on a Sunday night and they stay for a whole week. People don't do that here. We don't even have an international market. Our whole market is California. Wow. And our whole market is drive market. And that's a real challenge when it comes to running a ski resort. We are not a destination. And that means that we're really, really, really picky. And until we can make California turn into a destination where people choose to come in on a Sunday and leave on a Sunday, we'll never be able to drive really high midweek passes. And, you know, that's complex because we need hotels and Truckee doesn't have big hotels and we don't have big hotels up here. So the next question is, do we build a hotel? And, you know, that's a big, big ask.
Yeah. Gosh, it's so interesting you say all that because Tahoe, it's so beautiful. The skiing is so good. There's so much of it. You have access via all these multi-mountain passes. The Olympics have been there at Palisades. And I know you just told me you don't know why, but it sounds like it's even more baffling now that you've been on the ground. I mean, do you think Tahoe could have the ingredients to become international destination? Maybe if Reno Airport expanded or something, or is there something about it that just will prevent that from happening? What do you think?
I don't know the answer to that because it's a really complex question. I mean, the towns, you know, Tahoe City, Truckee, they're really small. They don't have hotels in them. And I don't know if the communities want that. You know, I've lived in both. You know, Queenstown was just unbelievable, the amount of hotels and hotbeds it had in it. Wanaka didn't have any. And luckily we were close enough to Queenstown, especially Cadrona, to get that business out of the hotbeds. But the town has to decide on that. The community has to decide on that, of whether they want that. Because it's a big change, a really big change.
All right, well, let's wrap up today with a little focus on the mountain. I know you have a little snowmaking at Sugar Bowl. I know that probably sounds crazy when you got 800 inches plus of snow last year and already at 400 this year. How extensive is that system, I'm wondering, and how much have you actually had to use it in your first two seasons?
Honestly, this season was terrible because we pretty much lost all of December. We got two trails open. So we really, really, really need snowmaking, and something I've been drumming into the team is if we can get open, we can make money, right?
Yeah.
And like the Tubing Hill is a really good example. We didn't get it open until the 29th of December, but the day it opened, we had 500 people lining up.
Jeez, wow.
So snowmaking is critical to get that first part of the season, which even though the snow's not that good, people want to come skiing and you'll get the business. And we do have an extensive system. It goes right over Judah Jerome and Mount Lincoln and the race arena. We do not have snowmaking on Disney, so we're looking at trying to develop that. The reason we're not hurrying is the first problem we have to solve is how do we get more water? We have more snowmaking infrastructure than we have water, put it that way. It's a never-ending story. It was the same problem I had at Cadrona for years.
Do you have a source? Do you draw out of Lake Mary? Do you have to have rain reservoirs? Where do you get your water from now?
We draw out of Lake Mary, but we're limited to how much we can take from Lake Mary.
Have you studied how you could potentially get more water if you could secure the rights and where that would come from?
Yeah, we've got people working on that now.
You know, with snowmaking in Tahoe, it's not just a winter thing anymore. We saw it here at Tahoe a couple of years ago when the Caldor fire came through. They suffered a lot of damage, but they had snowmaking, so that may have helped mitigate some of it. Heavenly has a huge snowmaking system. How much of a factor is summer and protecting Sugar Bowl in the case of wildfires? Because that seems to have become the biggest existential threat to ski areas in California, is that threat of fire coming through in the summertime.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, just before I arrived here, I was calling the place every day because the mosquito fire was happening, and I was trying to keep making sure that when I arrived, there'd be a ski resort still left. And it was miles away and it was fine. But, you know, that was a real scare for all of us. We have been doing a lot of work in partnership with the Forest Service on forest health. And last summer, thinned and limbed all of the dead and dying out towards the west of the village. And so that's a piece of work, and we continue to chip away at that year after year, and we have a team, it's all they focus on. So there's a lot of work, there's a lot of investment that goes into that. It's just another huge cost to running a ski resort.
All right, Bridget, with that, I will let you go and enjoy all that snow you're getting. Really sounds like you didn't have a good beginning of the season, but it sounds like it's ending really nice for you. So thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, especially given how busy you are in March. I know that's a big time out west. So thank you so much, Bridget. I really appreciate your time.
No problem. Lovely to talk.
That's Bridget Legnavsky, president and CEO of Sugar Bowl California. Thank you so much for that, Bridget. That was excellent and a very honest look into what it's like to run a large independent ski area in a busy ski region in 2024 when you were surrounded by epic and icon mountains. I really, really appreciate that candor, and I hope all of you listening did as well. Churning along here with the pod, more in the can already, and I am working to get you already reported eps with the leaders of Okemo, Tenney, Gunstock, and Panorama BC as soon as I possibly can. And I have so many pods scheduled over the next several months. To get in on those as soon as they are live, please visit stormskiing.com and subscribe to the Storm Skiing newsletter. New pods will appear in your email box several hours before syncing with the podcast services, including Apple and Spotify. There are free and paid tiers of the newsletter, and paid subscribers will receive podcasts 7 days before everyone else. You can also follow The Storm on X and Instagram at Storm Ski Journal. Until next time, stay well, stay safe. I'm Stuart Winchester, and I will talk to you again very soon.
The Storm Skiing Podcast is a Quicksilver Films production.